This is a Rooster Teeth production.
Harry, what is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
This is The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of, the podcast about collecting things from the movies we love. I'm Ryan Condal, screenwriter and collector.
And I'm David Mandel, comedy writer and collector. And Ryan, we always like to start by talking about what's new with props or in our prop world. And I am very proud to tell you today that in honor of COVID-19 and sort of the ongoing, like, I can't leave my house, I have started the great prop inventory of my collection.
Oh my God.
Very, very pleased. Many years in the making. Inventories suck, but they are so necessary. Have you done one? Have you done one lately? Have you been good about it?
I did. I had to do one because I moved. So I was putting my collection into storage, which is a whole discussion for another day, but I had to, I had to catch up with multiple insurance companies and just get it all. So yes, I did that, but it actually was larger than I thought it would be.
It always is. It always is. I will say for the new collector, my gosh, just start right from the get go. And yes, whether you eventually reach a point where you do feel the need to insure your collection, which I do recommend. And I think at some point, maybe we'll do a show about insurance and really kind of get into some of the nitty gritty of that. But I will
It's what all the fans have been demanding.
Yes, people just love insurance. A lot of our audience are insurance adjusters, and that's really what they want to hear
Very
about.
Excited.
But I will say that, like, even if you're not up to the insurance of it all yet, having a definitive inventory and list, and I'm basically just, I was bad about it, but if you start from the get-go so that every time you acquire a piece, you're taking a picture, you're listing the piece, maybe you're listing where you got it from, what you paid for it, maybe a space to update its value as maybe it gets, worth more down the line or less. Both things can happen, but you'll be good to go. And the beautiful thing about this sort of inventory that I'm doing, that I find, is by making a list of everything and really kind of getting a chance to kind of go through it all, again, besides the insurance part, if God forbid something happens, it gives me a chance to really not, like, A, look through, touch everything, find everything again, but also I begin to get to think about my collection. I get to think about my collection both on a macro level and a micro level. And you do start to go, oh, wow, maybe I have too many Star Wars storyboards. Do you know what I mean? Because All of a sudden when you see that list, and I have found that when you go through and you kind of put them all together and you go, wow, I've got 20 of these. Maybe I could get rid of 5. By the way, 15 is still probably a ridiculous number to have, but you do find, like, what maybe becomes expendable and down the line. It's a really wonderful, I don't know, therapeutic way of kind of dealing with your collection. To me, it's like puttering in the garden. That's because you're in London now, right? Isn't that what you've been doing, puttering in your garden?
Doing a lot of puttering.
But it's a very pleasing thing, and I will say It's been one of the few enjoyable moments of this ongoing pandemic, of just sort of kind of immersing myself in my collection. And I do believe, for especially, again, new collectors, but really all collectors, if you don't have an inventory list, get on it. And if you are just starting, start yours now. I just think it's really, really important.
Yeah, and really it's important specifically to track what you paid for a thing, because, you know, as these things go up in value over time, you are going to part with something somewhere, and you need to remember what you paid for it so that you can make the proper declarations to whomever, whatever tax body is
whatever tax body you choose to recognize.
Exactly.
I choose only to recognize the sovereign nation of Iraq, where props are not taxed.
So that's fantastic.
Good. Yeah, that's really good.
I actually, now that we're on the prop tax issue, really, tax and insurance, wow, really getting off to a good start here today.
For those of you still listening.
I have a buddy of mine, Tim, who I just saw in London, who's a collector, sold a Josie Wales pistol at auction, and was telling me with great delight that he just learned a gun is in the English tax code is considered a depreciating asset. Which, if it was another prop, if it was, like, you know, Josie,
if it had been Josie's hat or his saddle.
It would not. It would not be. But it was because it was his gun. It's going to depreciating asset, and you don't have to pay a capital gains tax on it, which
is very lucky. Illuminating. Man. Perhaps we will dig into that further when we get to our gun episode, right?
Yes.
You know, that'll be a little sub area just for you, again, you insurance fans.
Tax nerds.
But what do we got going on today, my friend?
Well, Dave, we've spoken a lot on this podcast about props, but we haven't spoken about to date a lot is wardrobe. And today's episode, we're going to dive into all about that. Wardrobe collecting, what is it, what it's all about?
Wardrobe enters my collection in the sense of, I think, you know, and again, none of these will be surprises, you know, genre film sort of uniforms or sort of, you know, sort of very identifiable pieces. Again, you know, the Star Wars, the Star Treks, those kinds of things, which obviously they are technically wardrobe. But what I don't really have in my collection are like, you know, suits and dresses and you know, sort of, you know, everyday wear. So in some ways, and maybe this is not an official terminology, but I always think if there's a separation between wardrobe and then almost like what I call like maybe costumes, even though costumes are wardrobe, if that makes, that's how I guess I like to think about it, if that makes any sense. Because look, for me, when you get into like, especially modern day films, it's really hard to tell what anything is. In fact, here in Los Angeles, there were a couple of shops, one called Starwares for a while, that basically movie studios would sell off just suits and dresses from, you know, modern movies that really were not identifiable. And I knew people that would go there and shop there almost like as if it were a used clothing store. And often, because obviously they use wonderful stuff in these movies, they'll pick up an Armani suit because it's the right size for, you know, a quarter of what an Armani suit costs, only to realize later, oh, this was, you know, whatever, Harrison Ford's suit in that movie he played a newsman. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or women being able to pick up dresses and things of that nature. Because again, they're just not identifiable enough. And I guess that's always been a little bit of my issue with wardrobe conceptually. And I know it's wrong, but I guess it continues to sort of be a little bit of my issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, props get a lot of the attention. And really, I mean, half of this hobby revolves around props, but the other half revolves around wardrobe. And we don't talk about it as much. When people hear wardrobe, it's like, you know, it's a Humphrey Bogart suit, but that's not as exciting or sexy as the Maltese Falcon.
You know, same thing, you know, a movie that I have loved and loved and loved and loved and loved. And by the way, this could have been a movie for our little game at the end, but I've now wasted it. The Godfather, a movie I absolutely love, but every time I have been confronted by the opportunity to pick up a piece of wardrobe. Most recently, I was looking at a Michael Corleone suit from Godfather Part II. It's a tan suit. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's and I ultimately never quite, I love the movie and I have odds and ends and knickknacks from it. But ultimately, I've never quite pulled the trigger on, even though it's one of my all-time favorite movies, on a piece of Godfather wardrobe, because it just, I don't know. It, again, I know what it is. I can explain what it is. I could tell you the scene it's in, but it doesn't quite, I don't know. It doesn't quite, I don't know, give me that thrill that I'm looking for, I guess, from some of this that we've talked about. And I don't know. Would you have a favorite piece of wardrobe in your collection?
I do. Yes, I have a couple of pieces. I mean, I think this one is the closest to what would actually be considered true wardrobe with a capital W. And that is, I have one of Deckard's shirts, Harrison Ford shirts from Blade Runner.
See, but I'm going to argue, but even there, because it's a genre sci-fi thing, it kind of straddles. But it's a shirt, and I will give you that sort of point, if you will. I'll concede the point.
I mean, we'll post photos of it on the social feed. But it's just a button down shirt. But what I love about it is,
but it's sort of an interesting material,
yes,
and color, and it doesn't look like, say, something one could buy in a store. I guess that's my only point. There's an otherworldly future quality to it.
Yes, which is what I love about it, because to me, wardrobe is, they were all custom made pieces that were custom made in costume departments for film.
Yeah, someone designed it for the film and for the actor. Was made for the film. Right. Yes, absolutely.
And this was absolutely that you can tell this was a custom, you know, a bolt of material that somebody found and then converted into a sort of science fiction, retro science fiction shirt. And it's the shirt that Deckard wears in the final confrontation. So when he goes to Bradbury Building in the end, when he's tracking down Batty, he's wearing
The fight shirt, basically.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
It's the one he's wearing when Batty pulls. If you remember in the film, he smashes his hands through the wall and then pulls Deckard's hand through the wall and then, you know, pries the gun out of his hands and breaks his two fingers, and then he hands him his gun back and lets him have it, which I always love that moment. And you don't see it in the film because it was apparently cut out at somewhere on the cutting room floor. But Deckard, after that, splints his broken fingers.
Right, he tears basically conceptually a piece off his own shirt. Right?
Exactly. So I have the shirt and I've displayed it this way with the missing square of fabric that you know he tore away, and you can tell even on the square that was like meticulously cut away by the costume department to make it look like it had been cut. But his shirt gets untucked, and you can actually see it in the film. And in fact, there's one of the lobby cards was released with the movie back in the old days when studios used to promote movies. They had these they would have put up the poster in the lobby, but they would also have these lobby cards which were essentially
they'd make displays of them and stuff.
Scenes from the movie and things like that kind of would hint. It was almost like a still trailer that would, you know, line up and framed in the hall, and you could see it on the way going in the movie to tease what the movie was. And one of these lobby cards actually shows that shirt in full lighting with the little square of fabric missing. So it's wonderful.
Oh, that's
great.
Very cool. That's really cool. Well, I mean, you definitely look. I'll give it to you. That is a piece of wardrobe. Although, again, it's a genre film. It's very futuristic, and you've managed to find one that is from a very particular scene with the damage and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, you've definitely, that is a great example, but it's not quite as, I don't know, again, that's, you know, it definitely is not the generic piece of wardrobe that
Cary Grant's suit from Bringing Up Baby.
Right,
Which would be, to me, more kind of classic, you know, Western costumes.
Which
you know,
is wardrobe. Wonderful, but it's just not, I'm sure, it's just not something I'm sure I recognize. That's the problem. I always appreciate these things exist.
So do you have a favorite piece of wardrobe in your collection?
I have a from one of my absolute favorite movies and favorite books, too. The Salkind Three Musketeers movie from the early 1970s.
Oh, wow.
I have Charlton Heston's Richelieu priest's robe, I guess. I don't know what to quite call it.
I honestly didn't even know you had this. This is great.
Well, I, you know, it's funny. I initially, you know, I was thinking about, I figured you'd ask me a question like this, and I was going to go with like, you know, Star Trek or something like that, or, you know, my fallback to Star Wars. And I did want to try and stretch a little bit and kind of show that there are these, you know, these movies. Again, this is a movie I really love. And again, it's very costumey. So it's, again, not just sort of off the rack suits. And this is a beautiful, you know, handmade, you know, again, very lusciously sort of red, maroon, very, you know, religious and sort of saintly, you know, frock that belonged to this, you know, master manipulator, Charlton Heston as Richelieu. And I love all of those costumes in that movie.
Yes. And, you know, wardrobe collecting was actually the foundation of prop collecting. And this is what we're kind of getting back to.
I was going to say the first people that actually started collecting on movies in the sort of the early days of prop collecting were really the collectors that were going after the incredible wardrobe, and very specifically, often the elaborate, like handmade, as we described, dresses that a lot of the starlets wore, like in their earlier films. You know what I mean? That was that's really the building blocks of wardrobe. And the other thing that I think collectors maybe know, or if you're a new collector, need to know, is that while the studios themselves sometimes had wardrobe departments, eventually, especially in the like basically 40s and 50s and 60s, there were these big costume houses. There used to be many of them, and then over the years, they kind of came together. I think they bought each other up, whatever. And so you ended up with this giant, basically, company called Western Costume that was really providing basically costumes to really all of the studios practically by the end of their heyday. They were located right on the corner of what is now their area was taken over by Paramount Studios, which is where actually I keep an office. And so it's right here in Hollywood. That was the old Western costume, and they've moved somewhere else now. And they still exist, but it's different these days.
Right.
And these big costume houses really were the places that were making things and renting them out, but then also keeping these things in stock and renting them over and over and over the years. And we're going to get into all of that. Since you and I are not costume people per se, we thought we'd bring in a friend of ours that is, that someone who's really good at this, collects it, and was there before us, and was there for some really amazing stories that he's got to tell. So please welcome to the podcast, Rob Klein. He's a former archivist at the Walt Disney Company. You may have seen him on Pawn Stars recently. He's been popping up on there. And he is the co-author of the Back to the Future Almanac, which is an incredible must-have book about all of the things sort of in the Back to the Future movies, props and whatnot. Rob, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, welcome to The Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of. You were the first real prop collector that I met. We met, gosh, you know, at this point, like 20 plus years ago. We were introduced by mutual friends. We hit it off. But you were really the first prop collector I ever met that really took it seriously and, dare I say, raised it to an art form. And so I've always, I don't even know if I've ever asked you this in real life. How did you get into it? Like, how did you find your way to collect?
I think I was possessed by the ghost of Bing Crosby or his family. We grew up in one of his homes, and right up the street was the old Columbia Ranch, which is now the Warner Brothers Ranch, which is coming soon. It's going to be a parking lot, you know, but that's a whole other story.
As won't we all eventually.
But I don't know. It was something about going to the corner store and just having the brain damage of, well, doesn't everyone have a movie studio that, you know, shares the corner, you know, where you go to, you know, your local drugstore or whatever. It was the Columbia Ranch would we go to. So I was just, I guess I grew up around it and was fascinated. My grandmother worked at Universal.
What did she do at Universal?
You might remember, she actually was in the commissary.
Oh, yes.
And you met her in there one day.
Yep.
But I asked her one day, I said, can you bring home one of the guns from Battlestar Galactica? As if, like, you know, if you work there, you can just, you know, ask and you get it, you know. You know, well, you guys know, you guys are producers. You guys get everything you want from your shows.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Did she ever provide?
She came back with the toy that was like, well, and of course, if you know Battlestar Galactica toys, which some out there may, of course, they're terrible and they look like nothing from the show, you know,
but it was on your mind that she worked there and that maybe somehow she would have access or that you could get it and that you wanted one.
Yeah, and I was aware of the fact that they didn't do what they did on the programs. They don't shoot a laser beam, you know. So I was hooked into that early, and that was it.
But wait, what was your first prop then? What was your actual first prop or piece?
Well, it was when I had found out that Universal had sold their sci-fi wardrobe off. And the Battlestar Galactica wardrobe was part of that sale. Well, what they did was Universal goes, wow, we have a lot of this sci-fi stuff and Western stuff that we don't rent. We need the space. Let's get rid of it. Sell it. And they sold it to another costume company called Motion Picture Costume Company. There it is for everyone to... There's the history there. And then Motion Picture Costume Company did exactly the same thing Universal did and said, wow, this stuff doesn't rent. We don't want this. We need the space. And then that's when they started trying to figure out how they sell the stuff off.
There's something really amazing about the fact that I think, especially if you're not in this world, that people have sort of trouble understanding, which is they might make something for a show like Battlestar Galactica or any of these things. And then when they had them in their inventory, you would and could rent them. And that's why, in the history of, like, say, a movie like Star Wars, in the Cantina scene, there are spacesuits, for example, because they just needed a lot of spacesuits that they just rented from Western Costume that actually were either spray painted a different color, but were, for example, a spacesuit that was previously seen in, say, the Planet of the Apes movies. Because again, there are things you don't want to spend the money on, so you go to one of these basically costume houses and rent. And so you end up with these pieces that appear in multiple movies, even though they may not be labeled so. Is that right, Rob?
Oh, correct. It's the spacesuits that were used in first in a film, Jerry Lewis movie called Way, Way Out that we would probably never know the title of ever again if it had not been for the fact that they were the spacesuits created for that film were reused in Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And then, of course, one of the suits got used in Star Wars in the photography that was done here in Hollywood for pickup shots and insert shots. And I know you guys both love and collect Star Wars, and you guys have probably heard that story.
Yeah, they ended up, George Lucas wasn't happy with the original version, I guess, of the cantina. So they decided to make it, quote unquote, a little crazier and more alien, and did sort of like reshoots to basically add more masks and aliens and whatnot. And that's when they added, you know, as many of these sort of space suits and space tunics as they could. And again, they just rented it to keep the price down. And that's an incredible thing, but you're able to track a spacesuit like that because they are relatively unique looking, as opposed to, again, saying like something like
a
shirt or a man's suit kind of a thing.
Exactly.
It's actually interesting because I was just thinking of 2001, which is a favorite film, I think, of all of ours. And there's sort of famously like nothing around from that movie because Kubrick so badly, desperately did not want anybody to be able to rent anything from 2001 that he just shredded and destroyed.
No, he didn't want his spacesuits on Planet of the Apes. And that's exactly why he's, you know.
So the amazing thing about Kubrick was that he knew the system, and so he knew, unlike, say, a lot of people in Hollywood, that his stuff would end up basically being rented, and he did not want that to happen, which I find sort of speaks to, that's the same guy that allegedly does, you know, 200 takes of somebody, you know, walking into a room, as far as I'm concerned. That's like,
right. That's
spot on for him. We've definitely talked about sort of the idea of sort of multiples of props, but obviously with wardrobe, it's the same thing, and especially in any kind of like an action movie or whatever, where, you know, if a character is going to get like, you know, whatever, dragged through the dirt or splattered with blood, there's going to be all of these different types of versions. And again, that can, whether it's an elaborate costume or whether it's just a suit, you're going to see these things. One of my favorite ones, and Rob, you know a little bit about this as well, the various Superman suits with their shades of blue and like what they were used for. Yes.
Oh, 100%. They're all, that's some one of those amazing things that you learn, that there's even different shades of Superman costumes going back to, you know, the 1950s, as well as in the Christopher Reeve films. Even the first movie had different shades.
It would be like if he was in front of the green screen for the flying scenes, it had to be a certain shade of blue. And if he was walking, it was a shade of blue. And I think when he gets wet, when he gets the kryptonite around his neck, that's another shade of blue.
That's the suit that I have. It says wet, and then therefore it was made of a lighter blue.
Oh, because it darkened from when it got wet. Oh, I can get that. I get that.
So it doesn't look like... Yeah, so somebody doesn't go like, that's improper colors for Superman. You know, when he's, you know, he's supposed to be blue, you know.
And is that suit from Superman 1, Rob?
Superman the movie, yes.
The Back to the Future wardrobe, obviously, is, again, sort of, I mean, at least especially in the first movie, then it gets into the second and third movie, you get the future sections and then the Western sections. But some of that is obviously sort of what we've been calling kind of like regular everyday clothing. I mean, you know what I mean? Like found items, if you will.
Off the rack, right?
And is that stuff you have and have had in your collection? Let's start there.
No, because we were finding like Doc's hat just sitting there at Motion Picture Costume Company.
Just his cowboy hat, basically.
Yeah, you know, which, of course, was custom made for him. They made several of them. You know, if he had just worn the hat, they might have been maybe five or, you know, two to five made. But in this instance, you know, he gets shot in the film in the hat. So it has portions of the film where it's got a bullet hole and some don't. And, of course, that makes for a need for more hats to be made.
Right.
So let me ask you this. What is your favorite piece of wardrobe from the Back to the Future films? If you, preferably in your collection or maybe was in your collection.
Well, never in my collection, but I can say this is the probably the number one most sought after or asked about Back to the Future piece of wardrobe. And that would be Michael J. Fox's jacket that he wears in the first film. And then, of course, with the down vest over it that they keep referring to.
Oh, as a life. Like, yeah,
as life a life preserver. Well, that thing is actually deceptively complicated. And to this day, there still isn't definitive proof if it was custom made.
So you mean the jean jacket part, right?
Exactly, the jeans jacket. But that's the whole thing. It's very dismissive as a piece of collectible wardrobe. Maybe it's just a guest jacket, or maybe you don't even know it's a guest jacket. It's just a jeans jacket. But when you start researching, you find out that the thing is really weird as far as it's got all these different patterns. There's a whole movie star motif of like silkscreen movie stars that's in the lining. It's very, oh, wow, very special. You don't really see it in the film as much.
I may have solved this. Is it possible, because he is so tiny, that it was just a child's jacket? No one's ever looked for that. Is that possible?
That actually, that is a wonderful theory. And I'll tell you, there are people, and you guys would know this, there are people obsessed that you find with every single, you know, item in, you know, movie and television history. You who knew that there's a guy who's just obsessed with, say, the comlinks off the stormtroopers, you know, and there's going to be the one guy that knows every detail about that. Well, there's those same kind of people that are really into the Michael J. Fox jackets and have actually gone to the Guess company and have looked through their archives to see what that jacket was, and they still can't figure it out.
Always racked my brain about, if you could really have anything from Back to the Future, what would it be? And so many people collect on the second movie because there's all those wonderful science fiction props, and the third movie because it's Western. But for me, it's like that first movie is just, from a writing
perspective. It's a masterpiece,
right? Yeah, total masterpiece, absolutely perfect. But, you know, other than the car, like what do you get? And I love that wardrobe because it's so distinctive, and you know it's almost like a character piece, because people are always, even when he travels to the past, accusing him of wearing a life preserver. Now, you told me a crazy story about how that costume was put together on him, and which would indicate, like, if anybody ever pulled it out of the rack and said, "Hey, I have Marty McFly's original wardrobe from Back to the Future," there'd be a great tell.
Oh, yes. The one that I know that exists still were sewn together.
So that it didn't move around on him, right?
Yeah.
There's something fascinating with wardrobe where, as you're saying, like, this was a jean jacket that looks like a lot of other jean jackets. And yet it may have been either, as you say, either a prototype or a specially made jean jacket, which I guess speaks to sort of both how movies manage to spend a lot of money when they want to, but also obviously the craftsmanship that goes into these things that any jean jacket wouldn't do. So they actually, you know, if someone did make the jean jacket. And there's an interesting thing. I actually got to attend a sort of a Zoom interview with Francis Ford Coppola recently. And if he's listening, we'd love to have you on as a guest, Francis. Anyway, and people asked him a question about the movie The Conversation, about Harry Call's wardrobe, which, again, if you haven't seen the movie, is basically sort of a raincoat, kind of a trench coat, if you will. And he wears it throughout the whole movie, and someone was sort of asking about it. And what he had to say about it, because, again, we're not talking about like a space suit or anything like that, and yet it was also very identifiable. And what he said, number one, was, in the movie, the guy is a listening expert, a surveillance expert. And in a way, he's sort of a private eye. So he liked the idea of a raincoat, trench coat, because it kind of saluted the classic sort of Seamuses in trench coats of the past. But then number two, he basically said he wanted him to wear it through the whole movie because it would kind of become sort of an identifiable uniform. And in a way, that's what goes on in Back to the Future, which is they kind of establish this wardrobe, and then that sort of life preserver, he kind of wears it for long enough through the movie that it becomes very identifiable with him. So within this movie of a lot of people dressed very differently, every time you see it, you go, that's him, that's Marty, that's Michael J. Fox. And I just thought it was a very interesting sort of theory, both on movie making, but also why sometimes in a movie of common everyday items, you can put specific things together that then become very memorable.
I think the interesting thing about wardrobe and the reason that so many of us gravitate towards it, no matter what your interest is really it's the thing the character wears. So it's really the thing that defines, shapes, you know, gives the silhouette of, I mean, we've talked about Indiana Jones ad nauseum on this podcast, but that silhouette of Indiana Jones, it's not the things that he carries in his hand.
Well, I think let's back up though. I think as long as the writers, the directors, the people making the movie are putting in that sort of thought process into what the character wears. By the way, obviously the costume designers and whatnot, that if the time is being spent on that, then you start to get into what I consider to be more memorable wardrobe. I guess that's how I would think about it.
Well, you know, Ryan, you just said something that I think is the thing about collecting wardrobe, if you're successful, is that it's the shell of the character. If you get a mannequin or just it displayed to the correct proportions of the actor, when you walk up to the wardrobe, you're seeing the shell of the character, and it's almost as close as you would get to maybe meeting the character if the display is done correct.
You know, it's funny, displaying was something I wanted to talk a little bit about, but you've brought it up. One of the pieces, and again, it sort of borderlines on, obviously, again, it's a little bit of sci-fi kind of costume wardrobe thing, but a piece actually, Rob, that you helped me get many, 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 many years ago was one of the Cylon Centurion, basically... what is it? Plastic, metal-plated plastic costumes. Those are the robot bad guys in the original 78 version of Battlestar Galactica. Later on in the remake, they became human-looking, but back then they are these, you know, Cylon Centurion kind of a thing. When you helped me display it, one of the interesting facts that you knew was it the UCLA basketball team or something had been used as a lot of the extras, or that the people that were playing the Cylons were tall. Is that more or less what was kind of going on? And so you knew that this will look better if we put it on an extra tall mannequin, that's the way to bring this thing alive, which when you're watching the show, you don't necessarily think about that. But in terms of displaying the costume, and I do highly recommend for wardrobe, I mean, you know, I just think a great display with like a mannequin or something like that can really make the difference and make something like this come alive. But by having this kind of, whatever it is, 6'3" or 6'4" mannequin, this piece looks fabulous.
I think a lot of the people that are not turned off by wardrobe collecting, but that maybe don't dive into it, are worried. You know, it's very easy to put, you know, to put a golden fertility idol from Raiders of the Lost Ark in a display case and say, you know, there's the
hand
golden fertility
props
idol.
Go on shelves very easily. Yes.
Super easily. And they're small and they're compact. But when you get Deckard's shirt from Blade Runner and it's torn and you don't have any other, you know, wardrobe from it, how the hell do you display that? And I think, you know, maybe Rob, you know, I know you're very involved in displays and you've kind of made an art form out of it. Maybe you can talk about...
The display is everything. And if you're doing your job correctly, making a display, your work really never gets seen. And people don't even think there's anything to it. You know what I mean? So if mannequin has been cut and altered correctly to the proportions... you know, you won't even really realize there's a mannequin on there. I loved hearing about your Deckard shirt story, Ryan. That's such a wonderful piece. And hearing that it's the shirt that where he, you know, he tears to repair his fingers. God, I didn't even know that existed. So,
I was really excited to get it. You know, I had just acquired one of the stunt guns, which you had also helped consult on, which thank you for that. I actually was able to, I mean, within sort of 90% certainty match my stunt Deckard gun to that same sequence.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it's really nice because it's like, you know, two pieces that go together really well. And I'll post a photo of this on the feed, but I put together a cool display that kind of puts them together. But with the shirt, it was really challenging because all I had was the shirt. First of all, the shirt's torn. So it's not even a full shirt. So I had, you know, I that's all I had. I didn't have pants. I didn't have gloves or anything. So what I did was I had a custom mannequin made. We started with a a base mannequin, and then there's a sculptor who kind of does this stuff on the side, and he shaved down the mannequin to be at, you know, Harrison's proportions,
right?
Based on, you know, just looking at stills from the film and how his wardrobe kind of fit on him. And what we did was, it was no hands and kind of no neck. So it really just puts the shirt out there in a way. Yeah, where all you see is the shirt. And the only place where you can see the mannequin is in that one place where the square is missing, just, you know, because what else are you going to do?
But it pops that detail out.
Exactly. It highlights the matchable, or the, you know, it's not technically matched to the film, but it highlights the sort of story section from the movie.
And Robin, your collection, and you really, one of the things I love about your collection is you have some classic wardrobe, but in some cases, it's a pair of pants. It's just, you know, it's what you could find.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, like with the Marx Brothers, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have Harpo's pants, and then I have a Chico jacket from the really early days. Might have even been from their...
Vaudeville?
It was a Vaudeville one, and then they filmed it. It's called I'll Say She Is. That's the name of the play that the Chico is from. So, you know, no one has that stuff from the Marx Brothers, and I found out the reason why is because the families have it. I was at the Academy... Wow. And they had like just gotten all of Harpo's stuff, and they had his hat and his trench coat, his shirt, his prop, you know, case, but no pairs of pants or no pants. Yeah. I said, well, they're hanging on my wall.
That's awesome. Actually, I would love to, if we could for a moment, hop into the DeLorean and go back in time and talk about the origins of all of this stuff. So, you know, Marx Brothers, vaudeville, right? We don't have to go all the way back to the silent era, but wardrobe back in the day in the studio system, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s was a very specific thing. And Rob, I know you've done a lot of research into this. You've researched it, you've collected it. Can you just tell us the story of like how wardrobe all started and how we got, you know, Dave brought it up earlier, how we got to Western costumes.
Oh yeah, no, it's fascinating. Well, essentially at Best, you know, we had the great studio contract systems, and you have to really start with the big ones like MGM. Now, of course, Warner Brothers is one, of course, or in Columbia, but when you think about those guys in back in the day, they were actually lower tiered.
Yeah, in the early studio system, the studios kind of had reputations for certain kinds of movies. And in Warner Brothers had sort of a lower reputation for just really kind of a lot of like gangster movies and things of that nature. And whereas MGM was doing sort of the bigger, more fabulous like musicals and things like that. The studios were known for certain products, I guess, is the easiest way of putting it.
20th Century Fox, they would have been, the Rolls Royce of movie studios. So they had their own wardrobe departments. So literally everything you saw those stars wearing was provided by the wardrobe department. And then in case in point, they would go back to the wardrobe department for reuse later.
On films from that same studio.
Yes, they did not share very often, though I would imagine if a wardrobe head was friends with somebody over at this studio, I know they helped each other. I don't know any specific wardrobe stories, but of course you hear that happening a lot with the makeup department.
But obviously if a leading lady wore a main outfit in a film, it may appear elsewhere, but probably not the leading lady of that next film wearing it. It probably went into background or something else, because obviously they were always trying to put the leading lady in the newest, best version of whatever the movie called for. So Rob, how do we then get from the sort of star system and these studios with all their, you know, as we said, amazing, fabulous stuff to sort of the rise of Western costume, I guess?
I think several studios got together and they formed Western. I'm not in a Western historical, the final word, but essentially Western costumes showed up on the corner of...
Yeah, basically, as I said, the corner of the old Paramount Studios. And that makes sense that they would basically look to save money by basically combining their wardrobe departments into this new company and pushing the costs off into this own entity of its own, basically, which makes a certain amount of logistical sense.
Yeah, so MGM continued on doing their own wardrobe. But the funny thing is, you hear that certain things were done out of Western. Perhaps the Inez shoe. I mean, I'll be skewered if this is not correct, but you hear things, oh, the Inez Shoe Company, who actually did the Ruby slippers, may have originated or one of the cobblers started out of Western Costumes or something.
And we're going to do whole episode about those shoe, the Ruby slippers, coming up. So that little plug for that down the line. But yeah, I mean, the Western had these amazing craftsmen, I guess, in-house and out of house, depending on what you needed. And they really became sort of the one-stop shop. And as I guess we're sort of saying, the stuff would get made and then kind of come back into their collection, so to speak. Really, the a lot of the key to wardrobe collecting, and this is now true with modern props, where I think a lot of stuff has barcodes and whatnot as they look to kind of keep track of it. But tags were really the key to a lot of these wardrobe, both departments and then Western. They had sort of their own code to it all, so they could kind of keep track of stuff. Different movies, like, I mean, again, I can tell you with sort of Star Wars stuff, there are codes on, you know, the early wardrobe. And if you're able to sort of crack the various codes, you can kind of begin to identify, like, oh, yes, this is from. And I basically can say I was able to, in my collection, able to put together a pair of Luke pants with Luke's, what's the word for it, kind of poncho that he wears on Tatooine and later in the Millennium Falcon. And
It's Clint Eastwood poncho.
Yes, exactly. And the pants have a wardrobe sort of code that numerically matched up with other original Star Wars wardrobe. And this was not something I figured out, but it was sort of verified for me by someone who sort of is a specialist in that stuff. And we were sort of able to kind of go, yeah, these look good. You couldn't just make these numbers up. Because unfortunately, in the world, and again, another show that we're going to talk more about fakes and forgeries, but people have made over the years, they've tried to make their own Western costume tags to make fakes seem real. That, which is horrible to think about, but is unfortunately true. Which, again, I don't want to scare everyone off. Doesn't mean, you know, don't collect wardrobe. But again, what do we always say here on the show? Do your research.
I mean, the Western tag in itself has become a kind of great find if you're going through old wardrobe and, there's a piece you're looking at, maybe it's been put up in auction or whatever. Everybody always rifles through the costume, anybody knows what they're doing, looking for that Western costumes label, because that's such a great start, especially if you're collecting things from a certain era. Back when, you know, when Western was the only house in town, if you want a piece of wardrobe from a major studio film, it probably should have that Western tag in it. And that's a great place to start. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you want to go to a guy who knows what he's looking at, like Rob, to say, hey, does this line up? Does this look real? Because I've seen both. I've seen the good ones, and I've seen the ones that are made to look like they're good.
Well, that's the funny thing about Western costumes, it's where you start off, you see that they've got this wonderful wardrobe tag, and then at least a few of the ones that I came across early on, you know, they would have the star's name and his measurements typed inside the label. So what a wonderful way to pick out look at this shirt, which is really nothing. And then you could see on the inside, it was custom made for, whoever, Michael Landon, for Bonanza or something like that. And then the funny thing is, the further back in history you go with Western, they didn't have the typed name, and then they would actually just have it handwritten in, which just opens up a whole can of worms. Because I've seen stuff that's as right as rain, and it's just written in Errol Flynn, it's right for, at least the people that were collecting it that I learned from were just like, no, this is how it should be.
Yeah. And Rob, something that we haven't touched on yet for you, but, you know, we both know you're a huge original series Trek collector.
You're a pretty big 60s TV fan in general, but Trek is sort of one of your real specialties, the Trek wardrobe. And you were there, basically. You were one of the first guys to kind of really go in and kind of combining your Trek knowledge, your Trek wardrobe knowledge. You were able to go through the Western racks and start pulling and identifying the original, a lot of the, would it be mostly the guest cast or was it everything?
What happened was, when I was working with the Universal stuff, there was a Romulan, 60s Romulan tunic, and I think also Captain Kirk William Shatner's vest from the episode Mirror Mirror, where they go to the alternate universe. That was in amongst all the Battlestar and Buck Rogers and Wiz.
Right, because it probably just looked like a space vest or something. Yeah,
sure. And then at the time, there was all this, you know, theories put by forth by other people. Oh, well, they probably rented from someplace and it came back to Universal. And in which case, that was actually true in some cases. But what no one knew at the time that I put together was, aha, prior to Motion Picture Costume Company purchasing the Universal wardrobe, they bought the Paramount wardrobe, which was that they did the same thing where they were like, oh, all this guest star sci-fi stuff isn't renting for us.
But Rob, I mean, you and guys of your and women of your ilk that were around during these days identifying this stuff and pulling it out of there, I mean, we always say probably saved it at least at, who knows where it ends up, right?
Absolutely. I mean
brought it into a collection, cataloged it. You know, I now know what this is. This is the, you know, this is a Captain Kirk tunic from Star Trek, the original series, and now could collect it and love it and preserve it for generations to come. And it was you doing that in those kind of early days before, you know, before the internet and before all this stuff was.
No, people didn't want this stuff back then for great value. They wanted it purely for the sentiment. There was no market for this stuff, at least early on. I mean, that's right. The other thing that's kind of amazing. A lot of them have sold off their collections, and ironically, you still have a lot of your collection. And I guess I was going to ask you, what is probably maybe your favorite piece of, like, Star Trek guest cast that you found back in the day?
Something you rescued.
Hands down, William Shatner's Romulan suit, which screen matches.
So that was when he dressed up and was sort of undercover as a Romulan.
It has a double meaning because I particularly like the episode. I love Shatner, and it also means a lot because I pulled
right.
it off
I mean,
the
I think
rack,
it's both
you know?
Finding it, the discovery, but also obviously that hits your nostalgia sweet spot. Western and these other costume houses sort of did also sort of open themselves a little bit to nefarious behavior, which I guess. It's sort of, you know, I think the statute of limitations has passed. But nowadays, when a lot of these pieces of, you know, again, wardrobe that were previously in Western show up, be it in auction or in a collection, a lot of them emerged from Western in sort of a very funny way. Do you want to kind of explain that?
Well, yeah, there was basically, and I think I could explain that talking about the Planet of the Apes franchise when I was getting into this stuff. And everybody has to remember that when you were like, oh, my God, you know, you first realized that, like, you know, I think I was working on a Universal show and I was like, can I come see all the Universal wardrobe from Battlestar Galactica? And they literally were like, well, you can come to the wardrobe department, but there's nothing here from that show. Of course, that wasn't true either, but that's a whole other story. They didn't know what they had, but they also were saying, you know, we don't keep that stuff. You know, we don't file it under B in our work. So when you start realizing, like, well, what do you mean? If it's not here, where is it? And then you learn, ah, it's out there somewhere.
There's something funny about the way they used to keep the stuff. Like some of the, what was it? Like the Imperial, not the Imperial, but like the Empire, like Grand Moff Tarkin, like those sort of, his tunic and the other sort of admirals and whatnot. And they would just get designated like Oriental butler. Do you know what I mean? Because they just looked like
100%.
They just didn't, that's how they filed it. You know what I mean? They were Oriental butler.
Oh, yeah.
And both are incorrect terms for many reasons. Yeah.
You remember the human, well, I know, you know, it's a humanoid is a character from the show, the movie, The Black Hole, the, you know, Disney's answer to Star Wars. And I think I found my, the humanoid robe in the monk section.
So how did this stuff get out the sort of less legal way?
What would happen is something would hit the rental rack and somebody, you know, working on, well, my, you know, my wife's family used to produce Charles in Charge, and they would say that, you know, they had done a big rental from Western Costumes, and then they noticed that I can't remember the name of the actress, but not Nicole Eggert, the younger sister was wearing the garden dress from Gone with the Wind.
Oh my God.
And it was just whoops, you know, and you know, Jenny's aunt noticed it, but no one else noticed.
Yeah, this was still a working rental house and the stuff just went back on the racks and anyone could rent it. And they had a policy, which was,
oops, if you lose it, you pay a mathematical equation times the rental value. So if it was a $300 a week rental, you'd probably pay 10 times the rental value if all of a sudden you that costume were
right, but that $300 value was based on it being, for example, a flowery dress, not a Gone right. with the Wind dress.
With the wind,
so it
right.
was to your advantage to quote unquote rent things from things you recognized and then quote unquote lose them. Is that the easiest way of putting it?
100%. And then, or the other way to have done it is, you know, you'd give them back something that looks like whatever they rented you.
I can't decide which I like more, the just sort of taking it and paying it or just giving them like another dress and saying it's okay. But what I know, though, is I like Charles in Charge that much more knowing they were wearing Gone with the Wind wardrobe. That
Well, it certainly adds a little production. But the funny thing is that, you know, Jenny Zant sent it back. They didn't, she would have, you know, she's like, I'll keep that, you know. But no, it went back and I don't even know if the
By the way, it's probably still
the
there.
Exists.
You can probably rent it, but it's probably labeled now Charles in Charge or something like that. Yeah.
Well, Dave, you have the whole Scott Baio wing of your collection.
Shh, that's a very secret part of the collection.
When you think of wardrobe that doesn't exist, like, I mean, I don't know how much you guys have really researched it, but, you know, there's certain things where it's like, well, where is this costume? And the answer is, well, no one seems to know. And then more than likely, that is something that was rented and destroyed by a production. Basically, so what would happen would be, you know, you start looking at the Planet of the Apes wardrobe at Western and you realize, oh, well, none of the stars are here. And the answer was, well, they've probably already had been rented and lost or whatever, because, you know, there were chimps, but the Roddy McDowells were long gone. And, you know, the Maurice Evans, Dr. Zaius.
But some of that stuff
no
has
there,
surfaced,
you know, so.
In collections and auctions since.
Oh, no. All the ape stuff, with the exception of one costume, from my knowledge, is accounted for now. And that's the really elaborate, I think he's
so
like...
So probably not rented for productions. Yep. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Do you have a favorite piece of like a costume or wardrobe in your entire collection? If you had to pick one, everything's on fire, you're running out, what do you grab as you leave behind your wife and child?
Wow.
I know.
It's so impossible. I guess it'd have to be the George Reeves Superman.
That's what I thought. From the original Superman TV show. It's a pretty incredible both piece and display that you have.
I like, too, that Rob is also, we know, is a real collector, because he did not even do the perfunctory, well, of course I would first go back and save my family. He immediately just got to the question, which we all appreciate.
Yeah, no, I had been watching that costume for a long, long time. And
was it in a private collection?
Yeah, well, it was with Cy Simonson. I'll just spill the beans here. It was with Cy Simonson, who was the guy who was hired to make Superman fly in any other way other than on wires, because the first person, the wires broke. George Reeves says, I won't fly on wires.
So he was the actual guy that did the flying effects in the original show. Gotcha.
For this... Yes, second season on, they went to color third season, so he had saved the black and white.
Oh, which they were no longer using. That makes sense. Sure. Rob, we like to do this thing at the end of every show where we sort of play this game where I'm going to name a movie and they're getting harder and harder and harder, and you have to sort of pick something from that movie show that would be sort of like your dream prop or piece of wardrobe. And I was trying to think of something, where the props are not perhaps as interesting that sort of then force us into the world of wardrobe. And I think I've got a good one. I thought this one would be a little challenging, a little difficult, but I'll throw it at both of you. Rob, you first. Fight Club.
Probably his jacket, the leather jacket, like the wine colored jacket.
It's a very identifiable piece that Tyler Durden is wearing throughout that movie. I like that a lot. By the way, I've seen the robes. I remember his robe sold, or maybe it was Norton's kind of ratty robe. You know what I mean? That was a piece that was bouncing around for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Rob, with your knowledge of wardrobe, and particularly in that period, I mean, is it your sense that that jacket would have been an off-the-rack vintage thing, or do you think they would have made that specifically for Brad Pitt in the movie?
Boy, that's tough, because I've heard they've made stuff for their Starsky and Hutch remake, which would have been just like, God, go to any vintage store and you'd pull that together, but they did. And then when you...
I think it's harder than you think with the vintage store. I know I was reading some really interesting stuff about the making of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and they definitely got to look at a lot of vintage stuff and whatever, but they ended up just, they made a lot of stuff in the style of, because obviously sizes and what they really wanted to find, you couldn't exactly find. And so you do end up making a lot of things, even for stuff that quote unquote ends up looking, well, not exactly off the rack, but again, you know, they're simple pieces. And obviously there are pieces they went out and found, but you know, they did make some of like the Sharon Tate wardrobe very specifically, like her sort of like jacket that she wears to the Playboy Club and then kind of kicks off and things like that. Ryan, how about you on Fight Club?
Yeah, I mean, I love this movie too. I will say as a brief sort of setup into this, and I've seen this movie a couple of times over the years, and I did see it originally in the theaters. I was one of the people that was there originally, and I remember I was in college at the time. And I was I went to business school and in a very conservative Catholic school and all that, and I dragged a bunch of Villanova business students out to that movie, and I just remember when the credits rolled as the buildings were crashing down at the end of the movie, I was looking around with this, like, I had the Cheshire Cat grin, I had ear to ear grin, my eyes were glowing, I was like, I'm just like, this was great, and I just turned around and looked at all the horrified faces of all the people that I had brought to this movie. I mean, they were deeply scarred from this thing, and they were like, that was terrible. What is this? What's happening to movies? What's wrong with you? And I remember saying on the way out, I was like, we just watched a classic. Remember this moment as we filed out of the empty movie theater. This is a classic. And, you know, I'm sure they're all having their own podcast right now talking about how I was right.
That's awesome.
But anyway, so what would I take from Fight Club? It has to be a Tyler Durden piece, because he is the character from it.
Yeah.
For me, I think this is becoming a theme. We talked about Jaws a couple of episodes ago. I like jokey wardrobe. It has to be the coffee mugs robe from the movie. So if you remember, in when they're staying in that awful house with the leaky roofs and everything,
right,
Brad Pitt has that. It had to be custom. I'm guessing it was custom made. Maybe this is just something they found in a thrift shop or something, but somebody handmade this thing. It was a bathrobe with all these kind of kitschy coffee mugs sewn into it. And, you know, Brad Pitt at the height of Brad Pitt, when he's the most, you know, beautiful, handsome man in the history of all men, wearing this very kind of, you know, mom sort of robe. And I just, it always made me laugh.
That's got to exist. I haven't heard of it though. But
yeah. I mean, I thought, and maybe this is where I was trying to reference, I didn't remember the coffee mugs, but I feel like a robe sold, I started to say, from one of those, but was it not the coffee mug?
I believe that was actually in auction a couple of years ago. And it was one of those moments where it's just like, there were so many things available and it's like, what do I take? And that was just one that lost out. But I believe that was the one, don't quote me on it. But yes, that robe, the coffee mugs robe. That's me. Dave?
I love, although it's incredibly generic, I love when he's dressed up as the waiter and he's, you know, basically peeing in the soup and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly. And he looks so funny in that wardrobe. Although, again, obviously it's just, you know, whatever, a sort of, you know, fancy restaurant sort of, you know, whatever, waiter's costume, which I don't know if it would... It's a weird piece for me that I'm not sure I would end up displaying properly as much as sort of just like I'd have it in my closet going, you want me to go pull out my waiter costume from that? The crazy leather brown suit is for me.
Yeah.
Now, is that that's a different suit than you were talking about, Rob. You were talking about the suit jacket.
Yeah,
right?
It's the one I you know, and I saw that jacket the other day and I was
the leather,
yeah,
or the one?
No, oh, the leather.
The leather for the me is jacket. How I think of him, is how I think of Tyler Durden. So I'm going with that. There was something about that character and his ability to, for lack of a better word, to pull off a leather suit.
Anything.
Exactly. That's how I identify him, and I sort of feel like that would look really incredible. And I don't know, for me, I'd recognize it. But again, this is all subjective. But that's where I go with it. So, hey, Rob, people can find your book in stores, right? Or in online, right?
Amazon. It's on eBay every now and then.
Back to the Future Almanac. And can they find you online? Do you have an Instagram you want to tell people about?
I do. It's Rob Kalang Collection. And because of you, Dave, I have been trying to share more knowledge. And
I've encouraged you. Yep.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's been fun.
It's very fun. You put up movie prop stuff, wardrobe stuff, occasionally kind of kitschy 60s, sometimes some rock
just
and roll
anything,
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, anything cool that I feel should be shared. And I've also been doing a lot of episodes for a show called Collector's Call, which is on a MeTV, which has been a lot of fun to do as well.
As always, please subscribe to our show, rate us, give us 5 stars, tell your friends, but rate us and subscribe to our show. And since I can never remember either our email or anything else, Ryan?
You can find us on Instagram at Props Podcast and also on Twitter at Props Podcast, which is also titled The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of. And you can email us at dreamsaremadeofpodcast@gmail.com. If you happen to have anything that was liberated from Western costumes back in the day, we'd love to hear your stories. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, everyone. And we'll see you soon.